At Ritual, we know what goes into the holiday season. The potluck planning, the gift giving, the spreadsheets. So this new year, take a moment for yourself with science-backed support that puts you first. So whether you're focusing on supporting foundational health with a clean vegan multivitamin or supporting your gut health with Symbiotic Plus, do it with 30% off your first month at ritual.com/podcast. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Okay, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
I'm looking at you, miss.
Run that, baby.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Ladies and gents, welcome back to the Imprint Companion. I am one half of your co-hosting team, Blake Howard. Today, I'm doing a little special report, if you like, for an upcoming bumper episode. So if you're listening to this, it might be in conjunction with a couple of other things. Very, very recently, in one of the most recent batches from Imprint, they brought out a really kind of fascinating and tantalizing and just really edge of your seat, interesting box set directed by Roman Polanski, sort of bringing, I guess, a series of films that have kind of been lost since a whole bunch of controversy in his life. We're not here to talk about that. What we are here to talk about is a damn fascinating film that I'm still not quite sure I've got a grasp of as far as what exactly happened, but to help me understand it and to talk to you about it and to be emphatic that this is really unexpectedly a great little box set of very interesting films is my dear friend Lindsay Romaine, who wrote an essay for Polanski's Death and the Maiden titled Be a Good Girl, The Severing of Self and Truth in Death and the Maiden. Lindsay, welcome back to a One Heat Minute production, but specifically, congratulations on your freaking awesome essay that is part of this three essay book on Bitter Moon, Death and the Maiden, and the Ninth Gate. First, congrats. It's awesome. I got to read it before it was published, and it's freaking excellent.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for having me. Thank you for your compliments on the essay. Thank you for letting me, kind of bringing me in and letting me get to write it. It was a really fun one. And my first Blu-ray essay.
Is it really?
Yeah, it was my first one.
Oh, well, that's so awesome. I can't wait for you to actually get your hands on it. Damn Australia Post, not getting it to you as quickly as you could. But can we talk a little bit about Death and the Maiden? I had never seen it. You'd seen it a few years before, like some time ago. And then when this opportunity came up, I sort of floated a couple of these films at you when we were talking about it, and you were like, oh no, I want to write about Death and the Maiden. It's from 1994, just to give you the log line and on the back of the disc itself. It says, tonight, mercy will be buried with the past. 15 years ago, Paulina Escobar had her life shattered when she was taken prisoner and tortured by a sadistic doctor. Now, through a chance encounter, she may have found the man responsible, but how far will she go to get even? Stars Sigourney Weaver, Ben Kingsley, Stuart Wilson. It is like a chamber piece. There's three people in this thing, essentially. There's more than that, but essentially there are three people. And I think Sigourney Weaver is just magnificent, and I think it is so ambivalent and wonderfully put together. I just had such a great time, and we were just before hitting recording. I was literally on the edge of my seat, and I couldn't wait to talk to you about it because I read your essay in sort of abstraction. I hadn't seen the film yet, so I was like sort of like reading it and And then it was just soaked, like I just soaked the movie in fresh after some time and then went back to your essay and I just had such a great time. But tell me, you know, without sort of going verbatim on your essay, but like tell us your thoughts and feelings on Death and the Maiden, because I think it's really, you had some amazing things to say in your essay.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I'd seen it years ago. I want to say on like Cinemax or something here in
It
the
feels
States. And
like a Cinemax movie.
yeah, I'm pretty sure. In a lot of my early movie watching, like I probably would have been a teenager or 20s or something. A lot of that era, it was, pre-streaming and everything. So you kind of would just wander into movies as they were on TV or something, and you didn't even always know what you were watching. Like, because I would watch stuff before there were even like the titles on screen or whatever. So it's kind of
Can
a fun way.
I just say, if I could, I actually was dreaming about it. So I'm going to say it to you now because that is so funny. It's like, you know how we do our little like watch list or like I want to watch? If I could just have an app that went and saw what was on my watch list on all these freaking streaming services that I had and just played it as a channel on my television, just in a 24-hour loop, that was the programming and just like did it in a shuffle, it would be the best day of my life just to like turn on halfway through. And it's like, oh, Death and the Maiden's halfway through. I'll just sit and watch, like, and like stumbling into a movie halfway through and then that inflaming your curiosity or ignoring it is such a fun way to engage with movies. Like, when, especially when you're like a burgeoning cinephile, you know, it's so cool. But yeah, you saw it on Cinemax.
I want to say it was Cinemax, maybe it was HBO or something, but yeah, one of those things that kind of had imprinted in my mind, but I hadn't revisited with any kind of seriousness anytime recently. So when I had the opportunity, I was like, oh yeah, cool. Like, I remember pieces of that movie. I remember it leaving an impression, but I don't remember all of the bits and pieces. So digging in will be really fun and interesting and thorny given the subject matter and its creator. And so I watched it. Luckily here in the States, it's on Amazon Prime, so it was pretty accessible. So shout out, obviously buy the buy the Blu-ray, but it's
Buy
also
the
accessible.
Blu-ray for Lindsay's. Buy the Blu-ray for Lindsay's essay. That's what I end up saying emphatically, is like, there's a bit of creation there, but no, it was impossible to find in Australia. That's why I had to wait until I got myself a disc to check it out.
And it's the accessibility was it's always nice when people can see films, but obviously having a beautiful version of it with a great essay. I'm teasing, hyping myself up, but I think it was a really fun film to explore and to really dig into. And I think I know I get into it in the essay, but it's a film about rape culture, really. There's no other way to put it. And a film really about misogyny too. And something that's kind of ping-ponging you back and forth as an audience member of if you believe this woman who's recounting this terrible trauma and kind of inflicting it on this man who may or may not be the perpetrator of it. And it's a real, you were saying, I think before we hit record, that you just like you were second guessing up until the end. And it really does play with you that way of like, is she just this woman who experienced something horrible and can't let go of it, and it's driving her to the brink of insanity, or is she correct? And is this man, the person who did this to her? And that back and forth creates such an interesting character study because you learn so much about this woman through her recounting of this trauma, and and so I think I. As the essay title says, it's the severing of self. She talks about herself throughout the film as both this adult version of her and this young version of her. And the young version of her is the one who is just living in that trauma on repeat forever. And it's like, how do you bring those two pieces of self together? Can you do that? What does it do to who you are as you grow older? And it was a lot. And Sigourney Weaver, as you mentioned,
She's
just a incredible performance.
magnificent. Yeah, it's she's so unpredictable and so competent, which is one of the great things because you're literally living inside, obviously, the unpredictability and subjectivity of like someone's individual trauma. Like they, you know, you're watching her heightening of emotions, her lack of control, and then on the and then on. On the counterbalance is Ben Kingsley, who is just like adorable, gregarious, kind in one moment, and then deeply manipulative in the next moment, it seems, and then in the next moment, just like sheer terror, you know, and the balance of these. And I think the probably more thankless role, if out of the trio, is the husband character played by Stuart Wilson. And I think that he does a magnificent job oscillating between the opinion, like the, he almost becomes like an audience, like third definitive casting vote of like, is this is my wife insane, or is this guy terrible? And there's other sort of political machinations and other sort of stakes that are brought into the story from him. I won't sort of spoil it, but I was just watching this like completely riveted, and I think she's so fantastic and powerful and vulnerable here, and you know, she's such an icon, so it's so weird to see her like dig into this kind of subject matter and doing it really like with all of her strength and also all this vulnerability, because she doesn't ever seem like someone who would not be strong. So that's also like a great casting note. It's like, who seems like they could never, they'd never be caught, they'd never be, you know, tortured, it would never impact, but it's like her strength is like how she's been able to like come back from that kind of trauma. So it's a really fascinating film. I mean, I would, it's one that now if people ask me like what a really great, like it's such, I just looked at the year, I'm like 1994 was when it was made. I was like, 94. I mean, I know we talk about things like Pulp Fiction, but like mid-90s just spoilt for just these kind of films, you know, like that's something that was extremely challenging, hard to recommend, but so worthwhile and such like a deeply affecting movie that like really moved me. So yeah, you did a great job, and thank you so much for having a chat. Any other tidbits in your research that you wanted to shout out that we haven't covered just yet?
Yeah, well, you kind of touched on it, but there is within this kind of smaller chamber piece, there is this outside sort of political drive to the story. And the story, wisely, it doesn't really even tell you what country it's set in. It's, I think, supposed to be Chile, but it doesn't really get into that exactly. It's based on a play, too, by Ariel Dorfman, which clearly, I think once you realize it's a play, that's very based on a play, that becomes very apparent, because it is really all set in this one spot with a small cast of characters. But I think that political, obviously it drives the story plot wise, because it is, you know, the husband is a politician, it, you know, there's all of that stuff going on, and it kind of works as like a counter metaphor or like a parallel metaphor for what's going on in this smaller space too. And I think that's what takes it from just being a character study into being this way more complex thing that's just got all, you know, all your cylinders firing throughout. So I loved that bit of context and texture to the film as well. It feels like such a hidden gem of a movie, and one you don't hear people talking about on you know, the various film platforms. No. I was gonna say film Twitter, but I think it's more film Blue Sky these days.
Yeah, film Sky might be. Yeah, I think that there's been a mass exodus, I think, from Twitter. But no, you're right. It's, I think, understandably, people don't necessarily want to continue talking about creators who have really problematic pasts. And I'm putting that extremely mildly. Yeah. Bad shit, have been convicted of awful things in today's environment. The unfortunate thing is, despite whatever auteur theory, or if you're like a vulgar or tourist, which I kind of in some instances broadly am, you can't discount great acting. Like I almost want to say, like you can't throw their entire artistic body of work out because they're awful. In fact, it's probably somewhat interesting in some respects to watch some of their work. It's almost like no one mentions a Woody Allen movie anymore, but like they exist. And some of the best and most hilarious comedic performances ever are in those movies. Maybe not by him.
Yeah. And that's the key thing there, is that these things exist. Like, you know, I think sometimes there's an allergy maybe by some people. Like, I don't want to touch that movie, I don't want to explore it. But the movie exists whether you talk about it or not. Yeah. Art by problematic people exists whether you talk about it or not. And the beautiful thing about criticism is that you can have those conversations, and, you know, you can steer things. I think if you don't have those conversations, it doesn't lead to progress either. So kind of reconciling with the art as it exists, contextualizing it. In this case, because it's a film about, sexual assault made by a convicted, sexual assaulter, it creates a real like counter narrative in that regard too. You're thinking about why, what drew Polanski to this subject material, and that creates a whole other experience while you're
Oh,
watching it too. And
absolutely. I mean, just you're like, sometimes a great question from one of my earliest film studies lecturers was like, where's the director? If you, all you vulgar auteurists out there, where's the director? And where is the voice and the tone and the texture and the style of how you're being told the story? But sometimes the director is a character, and it's like, well, I don't think the director in this, I don't think Polanski is Sigourney Weaver's character. I think he's the, I think he's the guy strapped to the chair lying. It's a fascinating, like, take whatever, that's what criticism, well, it's so fun is you take the text and you can draw judgments and those things about it and like reckon with it. But I, man, it's a fascinating one. And yeah, I don't think we should abandon that sort of stuff. I think in fact, reckoning with it, as you said, is the best way to do it. That's why you wrote, that's why you were, I knew you would be fearless. You are fearless and tough. And sometimes if I just said to some people, oh, there's a Roman Polanski box set, who would want to write about it? And genuinely, that's the common thread between the three great people who are in this booklet. One of them is Lindsay, another is Sean Burns, and the other is our mutual, great mutual friend, Scout Tafoya. Both very fearlessly reckon with the ugliness of creators and also how fascinating their art is. So yeah, I want to say thank you for doing it. I want to say thank you for doing this. And yeah, genuinely, obviously, when people talk about Polanski, they're talking about Rosemary's Baby and they're talking about Chinatown and there's all the big ones where they seem to have the where his life seems to be subsumed by how good the art is. But these are really three fascinating, almost like lost films. Also Ninth Gate stars Johnny Depp, which I know is a guy that not a lot of people are so fond of recently, but it's such a great thing. So thank you so much for talking to me about it. I hope you get it. I can't wait to see your little photo, like a photo of you holding your first essay. But yeah, it's been great talking to you.
Thank you so much for having me. And I hope people check it out. A lot of the things we talked about here, I try to reconcile with in that essay too. So
She
hopefully,
does it in a much more better and thoughtful way than us just getting caught off track and talking about streaming services and how much we miss Cinemax. But it's terrific. Lindsay's terrific. It's a great essay. It's a great film. And I would say that if you haven't, we've sort of danced around the exact mechanics of the plot and the exact revelations of the film. So if you do get your chance to get a hands on it, watch it and then read Lindsay's great essay. Like watch it cold because it is a really great experience. That was like something in this, all three of these films I watched pretty fresh. I had seen The Ninth Gate before, but this Death and the Maiden was like my absolute highlight. So I was excited to talk to you about it.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was a privilege to get to write it, and I'm excited to see it in print too.
Over the last 75 years, over 10,000 chemicals have been introduced to our food supply. Yet the EU only allows 300 food additives. But at Thrive Market, we bring our members the highest quality brands and restrict more than 1,000 ingredients found at conventional grocery stores. Making the switch is easy with our Healthy Swaps scanner, which finds better versions of all your favorite pantry, snacking, and home essentials without the added junk, dyes, and fillers. Plus, it's all delivered straight to your door. So if you're looking to shop at a grocery store that actually cares about your health, go to thrivemarket.com/podcast and you'll get 30% off your first order and a free gift.
Guys, welcome back. This is a continuing episode on Imprint Companion about the terrific directed by Roman Polanski box set full of really fascinating films and even better essays. The booklet of essays here is a compilation of three of my favorite friends who all of them are completely unafraid to talk about controversial figures. But I read the first line of my great guest for this part of the episode, which is, the first line is, "You're not allowed to pick movies anymore. It's my legendary friend, my favorite Bostonian film critic, one of my favorite film critics, Sean Burns." And I just wanted to say, when I read that, before it was even published in this great book and great box, I was like, I felt such a kinship. I'm like, this is why we're friends, because my wife is just like, I'm not watching movies with you anymore. It's like, I don't know what I'm going to get. I have a taste of my own and you're insane. You can watch these weird things. And I read that and I'm like, this is exactly why Sean needed to write about this. He wrote the terrific essay on Roman Polanski's Bitter Moon, which, straight off the back of the box, is about a mild-mannered man who attempts to rekindle the sexual fire in his marriage while on vacation cruise. Only problem is he falls in love with another woman. Well, it's kind of that's probably a little bit dismissive. It's a couple that are away. They're trying to have a spark, and the couple is played by Hugh Grant and Kristen Scott Thomas. And then it's Peter Coyote is a man he meets, seemingly a weird sort of like strange author, and his very stunning partner, Emmanuel Signa. And they meet and he starts recounting the tale of their absolutely wild love affair. And Hugh Grant is intoxicated by it. And I want to ask, was it you that said people who are like going crazy about The Heretic, they haven't seen Bitter Moon? I almost imagined that it was you that said that. I was like, people are going crazy. I'm like, they haven't seen Bitter Moon. They don't know that Hugh Grant's like a sicko. Like, he's been a sicko.
Well, he's
for years.
Sleazy. The box says he falls in love with the girl. No, he's erotically fixated on this man in a wheelchair's wife.
Yes.
He'll hang around and listen to this guy go on and on because he thinks he might be able to fuck her.
And
meanwhile, his pain in the ass wife is seasick and she's giving him a hard time and they're just having this miserable cruise.
It's a fascinating movie. It was the first time that I'd seen it. So I'd read your essay and had a chuckle, and then kind of it just passed through my brain until I watched the movie again. And then I got with the box set arriving and read it again. And it's a fascinating little grubby movie. And I think Peter Coyote low-key had this career of being in sort of erotic thrillers sort of thing. I mean, like sort of erotic movies. He was like a go-to guy for that sort of approach, which is so funny because he it wasn't what his later career was, but it was like at his physical peak, he was that guy. And so it's really interesting. And yeah, just...
Well, we all grew up with him as the guy from E.T., but really yes. He was this super like countercultural figure in Hollywood where he's like living in communes. And I think he like fucked every actress. I haven't read his memoir, but I hear it's astounding.
Yeah. That's maybe one I've got to get. I've got a source for, I've got a growing summer reads list. I picked up Lazarus Man, based on, I think it was you and Bill Boyle and a couple of others were like, this is my new favorite book for the summer. And so I've got a growing pile of stuff, but yeah, that might have to be it. But like, so I want to thank you because firstly, you know, Polanski is a controversial figure. We're not going to litigate.
Well, he's a convicted rapist.
Yeah. We're not going to litigate it here, but yes, he's a convicted rapist. He's controversial, but his art exists. And I think some folks have a problem with contending with that. And I'm also like as bad and awful a person as he is. And I think Sam Wasson's book does this amazing, you know, look at, for example, his best film, in my opinion, which is like Chinatown. I'm like, you can't, whatever kind of vulgar or tourist impulses you have that this is the guy that made it and therefore, you know, we shouldn't engage with this art anymore. It exists. And great work was done by lots of creative people to bring this together. And it exists, so we should contend with it and talk about it because it's fascinating.
Yeah, and I mean, you have to be a really loathsome person to make a movie like Bitter Moon. I mean, it lays bare these horrible aspects of the male psyche. I mean, for, you know, this relationship that Coyote accounts, it just becomes, degenerates into this mutual abuse and loathing, and it is so vile. And the only way to make this movie palatable, Polanski figured out, is to do it as a farce.
Yes.
Because the film, it deals with just awful, harrowing subject matter, and it is an absolute fucking scream.
Yes.
It is so funny.
Yeah. It is really funny. And it's also funny because Hugh Grant seemingly is, he's both shocked and not shocked about so many elements of it. He's riveted. It really
Yeah,
gets to
well,
that horny,
he's us.
pervert.
He's
Yeah,
the
he's
viewer.
us. He's the viewer. Yeah, exactly. It's like you're like, this is so weird and farcical and crazy and then awful. And yet he's still riveted because maybe I've got half a chance. That's the hilarious undercurrent. It's like the marbling. It's like maybe I've got half a chance to fool around with this lady. You've heard about the awful shit that has happened in her life and how awfully she's been treated by this guy. And what you're the savior. Like it's so stupid, but it's that's a character flaw that becomes so fascinating and is interesting. And yeah, it's a really great. I mean, you did such a great job with the essay, but it's a really great read that you've done. But it's a really interesting movie. Like this box set is the Ninth Gate, which is about people who are both horny and obsessed with collecting things, which is for me personally deeply relatable.
The Ninth Gate is like a return to Polanski's really good at these like oversexed elderly Satanists. Like we're
yes,
back in Rosemary's Baby territory here. It's sort of a homecoming in that way.
Yeah,
But I mean, another just hilarious movie. I remember we were just talking off mic about how what a drag press screenings can be, and I was at that one laughing so hard in this dead room of people just scowling at the screen.
But yeah, it's got that kind of like potboiler Satan mystery energy. But it's also just wild. It's and silly. And like I just love everywhere Johnny Depp goes, a horrendous death becomes the person he visits and it starts to get increasingly funnier. Like it's like I don't know if I should be laughing at this, but I am. So it is what
And
it is.
also, like, for someone with, I mean, I haven't seen it in years, but I just remember, like, for someone who was see such give such big broad performances as Depp, like this one's like really contained,
It's
right?
his
He's
most
so,
contained. It's his most contained performance. It's like since
and it's
Dead
really
Man.
droll, like these minimalist reactions
Yeah,
to this crazy shit that's going
yeah.
around.
He's just like, oh, someone's on fire in a wheelchair in their office. I'll just walk out. He just leaves, and you're like, did you not see that? Like that was insane. Talk to the police for the love of God. Yeah, it's a really, I mean, that was a fascinating one. I really enjoyed going back to that. But you were mentioning Death and the Maiden, which Lindsay Romaine wrote a terrific essay about. I was riveted. That was probably maybe my favorite. That and Bitter Moon, to be honest, because I'd seen Ninth Gate before, were such surprises to me. But Death and the Maiden is a riveting movie.
Yeah, it was strange this period in the 90s because I think these are three really strong movies and they were not acclaimed at all when they came out.
No. No, it's like it's 92, 94, and 99, the three features in here. And then there's the wanted and desired Polanski documentary. But yeah, it goes Bitter Moon, Death and the Maidens, 94, like massive year for
Yeah, I
movies.
remember seeing it in the theater and it got really poor reviews, which I was surprised because there was a really controversial Broadway production with Gene Hackman and Richard Dreyfuss, and I forget who the woman was. But it was by
Oh,
Mike
they did.
Nichols, and it was
Nichols
like a
did this?
comedy, I guess.
All right.
And they kind of played it for laughs, which I don't really get that
I don't
out
know how
of.
you could do it for laughs. I don't know how you could do the Death and the Maiden for laughs.
But yeah, so that was the movie the morning after the 2024 election, I had no idea what to put on, and I'd just gotten this nice box set in the mail, and I thought, well, this is how I'll cheer myself up. Instead of watching all of the pundits go over what went wrong, I'll just watch a play about the after effects of a totalitarian regime. And again, speaking, as we were about how you have to confront the art, like this is a movie about abuse made by an abuser.
Yes.
And that makes it really interesting to contend with. And you can be, I can understand people's not wanting to watch it, but also, if you can stomach something like that, it's an incredibly fertile piece of material.
Yeah, it's because you're looking for how the abuser is rationalizing and turning their character into somewhat empathetic. You know, like you're, and I think also the there's such an
And
ambivalent.
the play itself is such a rape revenge
Yes.
story.
And it's such an amb but it's such an ambivalent thing is that like throughout the movie, and I think Stuart Wilson does really the Lord's work there too. It's like throughout the movie, Kingsley's character, like you're not quite sure whether this is just a woman unhinged and is breaking down because of all of the psychological and physical trauma that she's experienced, or whether it is true. And I think the movie does such a fascinating job of like balancing out those tones and keeping you on the edge of your seat for the whole time of like, is this person insane and they're just taking revenge out on someone who resembles a past traumatizer, or is it that? And I think that it becomes a real, yeah, it's really interesting and in both instances. And it's also like he has such a great handle, for better or worse, on like attraction and sexual obsession and those sorts of things. And so it just becomes really interesting.
I
Whatever
mean, is there
you.
any filmmaker better that with enclosed spaces, like
No.
just lock a couple people up in a room? I mean, even Bitter Moon, you're stuck in a cruise ship for most of the time in this little cabin,
Yes.
or in the bedroom in this Paris flat. But
Yeah, he loves contained spaces and they never seem boring. Like he knows how to shoot every single angle. He knows how to position characters in the frame. He's very dexterous at that. And yeah, that starts right at Rosemary's Baby, of like apartment, New York City apartment, just claustrophobia inside a huge city, but it's all hidden and you're in like a tomb, if you like, in the middle of the city. But I really enjoyed this, and I'm so glad that you I'm so glad that you wrote the essay on Bitter Moon. But I loved
I
your
was honored to be asked. I'm on
oh.
between Bad Lieutenant and Bitter Moon. I am your resident pervert.
Yeah, there's no shortage of perverts in my inner circle, and I just want to say thank you. When I was going out there, Sean jokes, but it's hard for some people to contend with, like, do I want to write? Do I want to contend with an artist that is a convicted felon and particularly convicted sexual abuser? It's like some
A
people just don't,
fugitive from
a
justice to.
fugitive from justice. Yeah, I don't necessarily want to contend with that. But I think in all three of the essays, Sean and Lindsay and Scouts, it's like, no, that's actually a really fascinating way to look at this, because you have the historical context of the filmmaker that's making it, and it enriches, for better or worse, every single one of these things. Like, what are these angles? What are these things that are happening in his life? What are the texts doing, and how's he interpreting it through this prism of his life, this man on the run? Yeah, it's a really great box set, and I'm really grateful for your essay in it. And look, Death and the Maiden, cheer up movie, really. If you want to feel good about the world, Death and the Maiden, if
Okay, I
you
wasn't
want
gonna watch a comedy that day, right?
to. No, the comedy would not have been as fun. So yeah, look, thank you so much for writing it. Thank you for doing this little preview, guys. I really want to strongly recommend getting it, not only for the work by three of my great friends who did terrific essays and work on it, but just three great films. And if you've never seen Bitter Moon or Death and the Maiden or The Ninth Gate, you're gonna have a ball. Ninth Gate is probably the most pulpy of the three, but Death and the Maiden and Bitter Moon were just like both completely riveting and fascinating. And I also just want to say, Kristin Scott Thomas, I've got such a crush on her, and I hate whenever they make her just the prop in the relationship. Like, they're like, oh, my boring wife. I'm like, dude, she's hot. Like, she's, Mission Brian De Palma got it how hot she was, even in Mission Impossible. He knew. He's like, she is something fiery happened between her and Ethan. She was giving him an education, and then unfortunately she had to die. But like, people get it. So I love also watching how those actors are deployed in these movies, because that casting is so special, because it's like, oh, she's like so boring, and you're like, Kristen Scott's not boring. This is only gonna end badly for poor sleazy Hugh Grant,
Yeah, it was when he got in that tabloid trouble about a year later, and it was like, wow, we all knew.
Did you not see Bitter Moon?